Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 29, 2001. And the fireside room this afternoon is Bob Ekblad. Today's session's number is EKB0-2001-08. And the title is Biblical Perspective on Business. Let's listen to Bob.
Society. And so the government, the state, is important, and we must respect it as necessary to maintaining order. And so it has that function. But remember, it's called a servant of the Lord. And one of the things that the scriptures do is constantly point out that these servants of the Lord become separate from the Lord, and often become, they're given a lot of power by the people themselves. And they become like demonic. Okay, and that's where some of these other scriptures come and speak very strongly, like 1 Corinthians 15, your second text. Could someone read that for us?
Then comes the end when he hands over the kingdom to God the Father, after he has destroyed every ruler and every authority and power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. For God has put all things in subjection under his feet.
Mm-hmm. This is under the feet of Christ, right? Mm-hmm. And Ephesians 1:20 is very similar to that. It just names a few other names. So why don't we skip that one in the interest of time and move on to Ephesians 2:14-16, which describes some other forces that are not normally in the list of principalities and powers. Someone read Ephesians 2:14-16.
But now in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace. In his flesh, he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall. Is that supposed to mean?
Yeah, the dividing wall, sorry.
That is the hostility between us. He has abolished the law with its commandments and ordinances, that he might create in himself one new humanity in place of the two, thus making peace, and might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility toward.
So here hostility and the wall, the dividing wall, are both described as forces that Jesus destroys with very harsh language, kills hostility. Just like it says in 1 Corinthians, the last enemy to be destroyed is death, right? And then you also have the law and commandments, which are described as principalities, really, in this text. Now, finally, Colossians 2 is a beauty that someone, who would like to read that? Who gets to read that one?
God made you alive together with him when he forgave us all our trespasses, erasing the record that stood against us with his legal demands. He set us aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and made public an example of them, triumphing over them in it.
Okay. So here the principalities and powers are seen as submitted again, and there's a triumph over them. And it's the cross where this triumph occurs, where Jesus actually submits to the authorities, both religious and political authorities, and sort of demonstrates that weakness itself and submission this way of the cross actually is, this weak way is what breaks the power of death and breaks the power of evil in the world. Now, one more text that I'd like us to read over is Luke 13, which was today's lectionary, Sunday's lectionary, the scripture. And this shows us in how the Gospels depict Jesus' confrontation with the powers in less overt language than say, Paul's writings. But it's very powerful. The confrontations that Jesus has with the authorities are usually confrontations with the religious authorities. Okay, so who would like to read for us Luke 13, verse 10 through 17? You don't have Bibles. I will read it. Now, he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And just then there appeared a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. She was bent over and was quite unable to stand up straight. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are set free from your ailment. Now remember, this is on the Sabbath, right? So this very act of Jesus is breaking the law. When he laid his hands on her, immediately she stood up straight and began praising God. But the leader of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had cured on the Sabbath, kept saying to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be cured, and not on the Sabbath day." But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to give it water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day?" When he said this, all his opponents were put to shame, and the entire crowd was rejoicing at the wonderful things that he was doing. So this confrontation with Jesus, between Jesus and the synagogue leader, is there's many, many of those throughout the Gospels. And often at the end, it says that the Pharisees went off and they plotted to kill him. Okay, so Jesus directly, in public, he confronted the law enforcers, which the Pharisees were, you know, were the law, sort of the ones that decided what was legal and what was not legal. And that's, I mean, if people are interested in looking, exploring more how Jesus deals with principalities and powers, read those kind of confrontation texts. Mm-hmm. Anyway, now what I'd like to do is invite people in our group to share some of their experiences of resistance and submission to the principalities and powers, starting with Rob. And maybe you can tell them where you were and everything, Rob, too. Okay.
I spent 11 years in Guatemala. I had gone there initially with Habitat for Humanity and became aware of the fact that housing was the least of the problems in Guatemala. So I got involved with all of deeper and deeper into the Guatemalan situation there. And for a time, I worked with a group called Journeys for Peace and Life, which was a Christian popular education group. And they basically went out and trained groups how to become stronger in their own organizations, told them about the peace process that was going on, taught human rights. One of the other things that we did, though, that was most exciting for me is our work with Guatemalan refugees and these communities called Communities of Population in Resistance, CPRs. I'll give you a little bit of a background here. There had been a civil war in Guatemala, lasted a total of 36 years, brought about basically by the fact that there was one succession of military governments after another that allowed for absolutely no kind of confrontation, there was no political space in which to act. Anyone who tried to organize unions or protest the fact that at that time, farmers were earning about $1.50 a day for work. Anyone who said that was unfair, or anyone who said, you know what, the fact that there are health clinics with no medicine in them or doctors or nurses in them is wrong. They were kidnapped. They were tortured. They were disappeared. To give you an idea of how little space there was, how little political space in Guatemala there was during this time, in Guatemala, there were never any political prisoners. During 36 years of war, there wasn't a single political prisoner because no one made it to the prisons. They were tortured. They were asked who else worked with them, who else thought like they did, and then their bodies were disposed of. To this day, hundreds of thousands of people remain disappeared, their whereabouts completely unknown. Although little by little, especially in the last years, they began to discover just massive clandestine graves, cemeteries, pits where entire communities were located. There had been a movement in the early 80s, actually kind of started by the Catholic Church, to form cooperatives in the northern part of the country, which was mostly jungle at that point. And these were going to be self-sufficient communities, not unlike Holden Village, but even more so in that everything they ate was going to be grown there and excess was going to be sold, and it was a very communal kind of thing that was going on. And for that very reason, it was a threat to the government/army, which was at that time was the same thing. And at this same time, the guerrilla organization, a guerrilla movement that was formed by everyone from pastors and priests and high school students and college students and labor unionists, they were gaining strength and momentum in the country. So the military came up with this great plan, and they basically said, well, to kill the fish, we'll drain the pond. And what that meant was, anywhere where there might be any kind of support for the guerrillas, anywhere the guerrillas might pass through and receive food or lodging or assistance or recruit new members is a danger to us. So what they basically did was began the Guatemalan Holocaust and just started exterminating indigenous villages. During this time, something like 110 towns disappeared from the map. Just ceased to exist. Entire towns that were abandoned. The violence was tremendous. The soldiers would often go into the towns and put men in one building, women in another building. They'd rape the women. They'd kill the children. Oftentimes just by grabbing them by their feet and crashing them against trees. And this is, again, something that was just discovered lately. The stories had always been there, but now the forensic proof exists with these clandestine cemeteries. The buildings where the women were often raped, and the buildings where both the men and the women were usually burnt down to the ground. Or, in other cases, they were forced to dig their own graves first, and then shot and thrown into the graves. The reaction of the townspeople who had a kind of a heads up on this, who saw that the army was coming or somehow were able to get away, well, one of three things happened. Either towns, if they were lucky enough to submit and convince the army not to massacre them, they became model villages. So these were the folks who kind of submitted to the reality here, and if they were lucky enough not to be killed, they were forced into these re-education camps. They were forced to do civil patrol, which meant that men and young boys were given arms, weapons, and had to patrol around a town. And it was very 1984-ish in that if you didn't turn somebody in from the community that you suspected of being a guerrilla or a sympathizer or troublemaker or anything, then you were looked on as being a possible source of trouble. So people would turn in people that, you know, if we got into a fight over something else, whatever else, I might turn you in as a guerrilla sympathizer to make myself look good before the authorities and also to solve my problem with you. So these were horrific places. And basically, these were towns where they just they weren't allowed to speak their indigenous languages. They were forcibly moved so that whereas they had been living on a mountainside or by a stream, they were forced to live by these dusty roads, all in these row houses so that they could be easily controlled and they had no freedom of movement. The second group were the refugees. And these were folks who hightailed it for Mexico or for the United States. And the benefit being that they made it out alive, the bad part being that they were out of their own country and had to kind of get accustomed to living life as exiles. And perhaps the saddest part of that were the children who either grew up in Mexico or grew up in the States, knowing nothing of their homeland, knowing nothing of their customs. Those, of course, who grew up in the States lost even the language. Even those in Mexico, though, these were indigenous people with their own languages, their own customs, and all of that got lost when they went to Mexico. So these were folks who fled and at least survived and were able to come back years later, but paid a great price, especially a great cultural price, and also lived in poverty the entire time they were in Mexico, lived in the very worst section. The third group was perhaps the most fascinating group, and the group that I was most privileged to work with, and they were communities of population and resistance. Basically, they were folks who fled into the mountains and into the jungle, but never crossed into Mexico, and lived like nomads in the jungle. And in the beginning, they were just disparate families, just kind of trying to survive off whatever food and water they could find in the jungle. And as they came together and realized family and family, community and community, they began to grow and form these kind of mobile communities. The difficult part for them was that they were hunted down continuously by the army up to the very end of the war. And so when we were with them, for example, we'd occasionally bring them food, cooking utensils, school supplies for the kids.
When you say we, who's we?
We, this group that I was working with, Journeys for Peace and Life, which was basically just progressive Christians, Catholics and evangelicals in Guatemala. And the donations oftentimes came from the U.S., Canada, and other.
And if you could find the groups, why couldn't the army find the groups?
We could find them because we were taken there by these folks, but no trails and everything, and it took about 3 days of a hike through the jungle to get there. It was pretty miserable. Yeah. And but at night, you know, they'd have a radio, and, you know, there'd be all this conversation, and they'd have little fires going where they'd be cooking their meals. They had scouts all over the place to, you know, control that no one got close to the camps. But they'd send helicopters at night, and it was amazing to see how these folks would react. I mean, as soon as one of the farthest scouts saw the helicopter, the word would come in. In fact, the word they used was loose, which means light, and basically that meant lights out. So the cooking fires would be covered up, the radios would be turned off, and there'd just be this dead silence in the jungle while the helicopters flew over and basically looked for these camps. Sometimes they found them, and they were bombed, and sometimes they were forced to flee temporarily into Mexico. But the benefit there, these groups, through just sheer act of resistance, through sheer staying one step ahead of the authorities, were able to maintain their cultures, their languages, their customs. In fact, they became very adept at kind of, what's that kind of training where someone who knows, apprenticeship. So that those who had skills before they fell into the jungle would then teach others. There were schools, there were nurses, there were chaplains, you know, lay pastors in the community. And to cut to the chase here, because there is a happy ending, because they were able to resist all those years of the war, when the war was finally over, as part of the peace accords and part of that process, they were allowed to come back into their original lands where they had fled so many years before and reestablish their cooperatives. So they are now back in the country where they are. But of all those groups, they are probably the most, the ones who suffered most and at the same time suffered least, because they were able to rely on themselves.
Was there a chaplain? Were there Christian chaplains or were there Mayan priests?
Both, actually. And there was actually an interesting mix of both customs at the same time.
Yeah. So, resistance, this is an incredible story that includes both submission and, you know, with great sacrifice to people's freedom, and then fleeing, and then the other would be resistance, right? Another story of resistance is Bonifacio's, which is a different sort of resistance. You see, sí. Boni quiere sí. contar la historia de cómo entraste.
Sí.
He's going to tell a story of how he came into the United States.
Sí. Mi nombre es Bonifacio.
My name is Bonifacio.
Nayarit, México.
I'm from Nayarit, Mexico.
Voy a contarles algo de que me pasó cuando me vine de México.
I want to tell you something that happened to me when I came from Mexico to here.
Pues yo salí de México por la situación que estábamos.
I left Mexico because of the situation that we found ourselves in there.
Y porque el sueldo que nos pagaban ahí pues no era muy suficiente para sostener la familia.
Because what we're paid there is not sufficient to sustain our families.
Y cuando yo llegué a la ciudad de Tijuana, México.
And when I came to the city of Tijuana, Mexico.
Encontré unas familias como que si Dios me las hubiera puesto en mi camino.
I found families that it was like God placed them in my path.
Duré 2 días en Tijuana.
I was 2 days in Tijuana.
Y cuando yo hice el intento de entrar a este estado,
and when I tried to come into this country,
en la persona donde yo estaba ahí en su casa,
there was a person there in their home, this person
dijo tú vas a entrar a este estado, yo te voy a, me pasó a un cuarto donde tenía una,
he says, you're going to go into the United States, let me bring you into my house, and brought him into his special
mis
room
amigos,
and,
his house, mis amigos,
and all my friends,
y dijo voy a hacer unas oraciones por usted,
and I will make some prayers for you.
Él tenía una ermita o un, ¿cómo se dice?
Altar. He had a little altar and a little prayer room.
En un cuarto privado.
In a special private room. This house.
Y dijo, esta noche entran ustedes para el otro lado.
And he says, this night you will enter the United States, on the other side.
Y sé que Dios les va a cubrir los ojos y los sentidos a los inmigrantes.
Cover the eyes and the senses of the immigrant, of the INS workers.
Así los tengan cerca a una distancia como de aquí.
So even if you're close, like from here to there, they will not see you.
Porque yo sé lo que es pasar el camino por la línea, por los montes.
Because I know what it's like to cross over the border through the hills.
Y intentamos entrar a las 10 de la noche.
And we tried to enter at 10 at night. Crossover.
Lo logramos.
And we made it in.
Estuvimos adentro en el monte, pero ya en tierras americanas.
We were inside the country, inside the United States, in the desert.
Esperando que se hicieran entre 2 o 3 de la mañana.
Waiting for it to be like between 2 and 3 in the morning.
Para poder caminar otros 4 horas de camino en el desierto.
To be able to walk 4 hours further in through the desert.
Y ahí es donde yo vi cuando esperábamos las 2, 3 de la mañana.
And that's when I saw that while we were waiting between 2 and 3 in the morning.
Y yo estaba acostado con mis dos sobrinas y otros amigos.
And I was laying down with, side by side with my
abajo de un árbol
two
chiquito.
Relatives and two friends under a tree.
Y yo como estaba dormido.
And I was sleeping.
Roncaba mucho.
I snored a lot.
Y mis amigos estaban con el temor de.
And my friends were afraid.
Porque estaban las personas,
because
los inmigrantes,
the INS people were looking around us,
con caballos y
horses,
y perros,
and dogs,
a la gente.
They were sniffing around for the people.
Y ahí es donde yo sentí que Dios es muy grande.
And that's where I felt that God is very big.
Logramos pasar,
we were able to
a un
pass
hotel.
To get to a hotel.
Cuando antes de pasar había un hotel cerca del por ahí donde daba el freeway.
But right before that, there was another hotel right by where the freeway was.
Habría que pasar un río o arroyo, no sé.
And we had to pass like a little river.
De aquí a la pared de la casa.
Like from here to the other side of the room.
Y el hombre que nos iba guiando.
And the man who was guiding us.
Me dijo, hey, hombre, súbeme arriba en tu hombro para que me pases para el agua, no quiero mojarme.
He said, let me get on top of your shoulders so we can go through the water because I don't want to get wet.
Y como yo era de hombre y las demás mujeres,
and I was the only man and all the rest were women.
Y eran mujeres de 14, 15, 17 años.
And there were girls that were 14, 15, 16 year olds.
Y tuve que hacerlo.
And I had to do it.
Cargar al hombre y de las mujeres.
I carried the man across and I carried the woman across.
Yo cansado de mis pies por
me, my legs very tired
caminar,
from walking.
Terrenos que no conocía
through
en la noche,
countryside in the middle of the night, I didn't know and ups and downs.
Pero pienso yo que todo esto, como dice el dicho, todo esto tiene su recompensa.
But I think that all of this has its, like the saying goes, all of it has its recompense.
Y esperamos en Dios, la voluntad de Dios.
And we hope for in the will of God.
Todo, Señor.
That's everything.
Gracias.
Rocío. There are many other types of submission and resistance once you're in the United States as an immigrant, which Rocío is going to share.
Tomando un poco en cuenta el texto de Romanos.
Taking into account a little bit of the scripture from Romans 13.
Nosotros, pues, el entrar ilegalmente, faltando a la ley, es una manera de resistencia, ¿verdad?
When we come into the United States illegally,
llegar
not, in face of the law, that's a type of resistance.
Llegar y, pues, conseguir un seguro social chueco.
When we come in and we get a false social security number or a false green card.
es otro tipo de resistencia.
This is another kind of resistance.
Todo por cuestión de supervivencia.
All of it is because we want survival.
Pero también nos sometemos a esos poderes que existen en la tierra.
But at the same time, we also submit to the powers that exist on this earth.
Si nos encontramos con la migra, generalmente no nos vamos a poner al tú por tú. Nosotros nos dejamos.
If we find ourselves caught by the border patrol, we don't resist. We let ourselves be caught.
Ahora, cuando llegamos acá a los Estados Unidos, pues uno trata de a pesar de estar fuera de la ley, estar dentro también.
When we come to the United States, even though we're outside of the law, we try to be inside the law as much
Tratamos
as possible.
De conseguir nuestra licencia, por ejemplo, aquí en el estado de Washington.
We try to get our driver's license.
A Dios gracias, podemos conseguir licencia.
Here in the state of Washington, we're able to get driver's license.
Tratamos de conseguir un seguro del carro.
We try to get insurance for our car.
Para tratar de evitar los problemas.
To try to avoid problems.
Entonces, en parte también nosotros nos sometemos y además.
So we also try to submit ourselves to
them. Porque también venimos de una sociedad, aunque un poco atrasada, pero es una sociedad y nos adaptamos. Tenemos que adaptar las reglas de Estados Unidos.
We come from a society that maybe is a little backward, but when we come here, we need to submit ourselves to this society.
Es diferente, es un poco diferente en el ministerio.
Our ministries.
A veces la gente llega.
Many people come at times.
Por problemas con la policía.
With problems with the police that they have. Often.
Por ignorancia.
Oftentimes because of ignorance.
Uno trata de guiarlos, de ayudarlos.
So we try to guide them. We try to help them to understand a little bit.
Que a veces son más complicadas las leyes.
They have to understand that sometimes the laws here are very complicated. They need to know. What we find, though, is that many of the employers and people within the country, often, U.S. citizens and U.S. employers and different people, they're trying to resist the laws and are not respecting the laws at the same time as a lot of the immigrant workers. You know, immigrant people have to, often feel obligated to resist in order to be able to come in because there's no legal way for them to come into the country. But once they're here, what they find is they're up against individuals and systems that often don't respect the laws themselves. And Lourdes has a story related to this.
Mi nombre es Lourdes Prieto.
My name is Lourdes Prieto.
Vengo del estado de Nayarit.
I come from the state of Nayarit, Mexico.
Vine a trabajar a los Estados Unidos.
I came to work here in the United States.
Me pasó un caso.
And something happened to me.
De mi espalda. En el lugar de care center del Monterrey.
Something happened to me when I was working in a care center. Something happened to my back.
Fui a labores de industria.
I went to labor and industry.
L&I. Y de ahí me mandaron a la clínica de CIMAR.
And there they sent me to CIMAR clinic.
Me atendió la doctora.
And there was a doctor
por
who
un mes.
At me for a whole month.
Me dieron medicina.
Gave me medicine.
Y como no trabajaba, me pagaron dos quincenas.
And since I wasn't working during that time, they paid me for two 15-day periods.
Y fui que me chequearan.
And then they looked at me, just gave me a checkup.
Y dijo la doctora que ya estaba bien.
And the doctor said I was all better.
Y yo todavía me sentía mal.
And I still felt really bad.
Y luego dijo la doctora que ya podía trabajar.
And the doctor said I could work.
Duré trabajando 8 días.
I continued working 8 days.
Y el manager me dijo que ya no había trabajo.
And the manager told me then after that there was no more work.
Yo creo que para que ya no los molestara que seguía mal de mi espalda.
¿Cómo?
Que yo creo para que ya no los molestara que seguía yo mal de mi espalda.
She thinks, I think because they didn't want to have more troubles because I continued to have back problems. That's why they fired me.
Y yo todavía sigo... Pues mal,
and I still have bad in my back. I still have a back problem. And I'd like for them to continue helping me.
Yeah.
This was in 1998. And so we find we deal with lots of people, lots of situations like this where immigrants have accidents on the job and are not recompensed, and employers try to find ways to get around the law, even using systems like, even using doctors and different people. Mm-hmm. And it's a tremendous abuse of people. And many of these workers are unable to work. doing any kind of heavy, any of the work that they're able to do, they're no longer able to do that with the back problems and different physical problems they have from job site accidents.
I might add too that there's another way that many of the employers will break the law when it's convenient for them, and that is that we all know that hardly anybody wants to do the hard backbreaking work of picking in the fields and so forth. So there's this huge force that is needed to pick the strawberries, cucumbers, berries, everything, in all these areas where we have produce. But in order to work, you need to have a card, a green card. Well, almost every employer knows that most of their employees, I would say, 90% or so, have what they call, the papeles chuecos, the false identities. But they continue to let them work anyway, knowing that, because they can't get a gringo to work out there in the fields, right? But what is interesting is that oftentimes we've seen this happen, that at the end of the growing season, coincidentally, even on the very last day, after the season, immigration will come and simply surround a field and ship everyone off. So it's like it works for the growers. Many of the growers are the fish processing plant operators, to have this force when they need them, and then when they're no longer needed, it's like, get them, the migra, and ship them back to Mexico, knowing that they'll be back again the next year. Although this year we had a problem where people found that there's so many workers coming up here to pick that they could only get like maybe half-time jobs, working 4 hours a day at the most, picking berries, which meant that for the growers it was great because they got all their strawberries, every single strawberry picked, but folks were just scraping by such a little amount per day that they said we'll never come back again. So we're seeing that things may be changing for the powerful here in this country, but the resistance, it'll be resistance. It's going to cost everybody.
Right, and this is also to kind of expand beyond that, just so we don't focus all the blame on the growers.
Well, that's the international market.
The thing is that, they make good use of these folks, while they're here, pay them as little as they can, and then as soon as they're done, as soon as their useful time is over with, they ship them out. It's not only at the end of the season, it also happens with older growers.
Yeah, right.
They'll come up here year after year, or families will
pickers.
Come up.
Pickers.
Pickers,
right.
Yeah, thank you. And if the family comes up, and this year grandpa's not picking as fast, he'll be fired.
Mm-hmm.
Now what's he supposed to do? He can't go back to Mexico. The family's up here, but he's not being paid, so now he's an additional cost to the family. But the real point I want to make is that it's not just the grower who's getting away with paying them very little. The growers are doing that because the strawberry growers, because Bear Ice Cream, wants to pay as little as possible for the berries that they're going to use in their ice cream. And why? Because the American public wants to pay as little as possible for their ice cream.
Right.
So we don't want to just focus in on those evil growers. This is a problem that touches us.
Everybody has their hand in it.
Right.
One more example of this kind of resistance and submission. I, as chaplain of Skagit County Jail, I deal with many, many. I have two Bible studies a week, and usually have between 10 and 20 immigrant inmates that come to the Bible studies. And many of them had come to me afterwards, and they said, "Look, I've been here 2 weeks, and no one's visited me. No attorney. I don't know what. There's charges against me, but I don't have anyone to defend me. And I've been told I have a public defender, but I don't know who they are. And besides, I didn't do this." Sometimes they'll say, "I feel really bad that I did this." I mean, they're often very honest, but I've seen cases where it's not at all clear that they're guilty. Anyway, I get involved with these people and get involved with their public defenders. Sometimes I'll call the public defender the next day and say, "Well, are you going to visit this guy?" And they'll say, "Oh, I'm just swamped. I have 35 cases, and I just was sick for 5 days." you know, and I'll sympathize with them and then say, look, if there's anything I can do to help you, I want to let you know that I visit this person one-on-one. I'm getting to know them pretty well, and I'd like to be of support if you think you can use me. And the public defenders are very grateful for that because they have sort of a thankless job. And so I get involved in standing, you know, with people and learning the details of their cases. And sometimes or often I and other members of our ministry go and we'll go to court with people and sometimes even testify on their behalf. And what we find more and more is the longer I've been doing this work, the more I see that the laws, you know, we're encouraging people to submit to are actually laws that are very unjustly applied and enforced. You know, if you have money, you can get out of almost anything in this country, you know, which we see left and right. And even if you are, and if you're not guilty, sometimes, it's the police's word and the narcotics, you know, agents, task force people's word against, often just their word against, maybe one or two individuals who are being accused. And so there's tremendous injustices that we see. But in terms of our role, we see our role as trying to stand with the people and push the law in a way so that the law is, so that people have adequate representation, you know, fair representation before the law. And so in a way it's submission, but pushing the, you know, I mean, trying to submit to what the law really does say and trying to get out from under what the law really doesn't say. It's like, I mean, that's really the role of a public defender or, you know, criminal defense attorney, whatever. So anyway, that what we find is that there's an interesting role that we have that is, you know, in the scriptures you have the word, the Satan, which is the one who accuses, the accuser. And really this is a function that the people that we're working with, you know, the individual immigrants who have charges against them, are being accused by the, you know, by the prosecutor. And unfortunately, most of them see that the church is right here. You know, the mainstream America is right here supporting the accuser, because the accuser is standing with the law, right? The accuser says, based on these laws, you are guilty of this, and I accuse you, and here's the evidence. Bang, bang, bang. Right? Okay? And most people, since we are a democratic society, we claim, and all of our representatives, the priests of our culture, are called lawmakers. You know, most of us are proud of the fact, or many, most Americans are proud of the fact that we elect these people that make the laws. So the average person, the average accused, senses, feels like mainstream people are standing with the accuser, including the church. They don't see any distinction. So what we see our role to be is the defender. And of course, this is all before the judge, right? This is that, when you have the judge up here. The judge is often seen as synonymous with God. Anyway, the defender is the attorney who actually stands beside this person. And this defender is actually the same function as what we call, you know, the paraclete, or the, you know, and that's the term for the Holy Spirit in the scriptures. So anyway, there's a role of the church to stand right here as the paraclete. Paraclete comes from beside, and kaleo, which is to call out, so to call out from beside. And that's where the word defender comes. You know, the Holy Spirit is called the defender, and all, or the advocate. And so really, this is where we, in our ministry, we try to stand together with the public defender and with, you know, with the people, defending them before the judge and, you know, and against the Satan or the accuser. And I believe that this is one thing that Christians and the church, this is one thing people have been asking, what can we do? How can we respond? If we can understand our function as body of Christ to be with the to be on this, you know, on the side of the accused rather than allied with the accuser, I think the people would find, you know, this Emmanuel, God with us, more believable.
Especially those who have such a small voice that are kind of here by Isaiah, and the ones that are sort of forgotten in the prisons, or the migrant workers out there that maybe speak Mixteco or some other Indian language. They don't even speak Spanish that well. That are just, they feel like they have no one to speak on their behalf.
So we see our role in our ministry is to stand with immigrants and inmates and you know, just the underclass that we happen to be to serve in our particular context. And in this ministry of the Holy Spirit, which for us is just a very great pleasure and made very challenging and inspiring.
We invite some time for questions so we can have an opportunity to take advantage of this pretty unique opportunity.
And also one of the things I guess we'd also like to invite is your ideas. We found, actually they found it and then I found them, but they found their niche, their area of work where they feel they can do their resistance. And I'm glad to be a part of that. But one of the things we're also interested in hearing is where do you folks in your own realities, in your own communities, feel like you can also participate in your own type of resistance, and what that means for you even. And at the same time, if you have questions, I'm more than happy to hear those too.
Or reactions.
Earlier, when you were telling us your stories or the situations where at the end of the season the INS will surround the field or factory, and you'd use the phrase send them back or whatever, but can you describe what actually happens a little? I mean, is there a legal process? Do they just round people up and put them on planes?
Unless they're on video, which is what we started doing after a while, then they behave differently.
Normally what they do is they'll come, they haven't been surrounding fields lately, but more like factories, like processing plants. A couple years ago they were doing this quite often in our county. They would have 25 agents or so with big German shepherds and with a helicopter above, and they would surround a block place of work. And they would go in and they would round up all the people, and a lot of times people would hide in every possible corner and inside of freezers and all kinds of places, and they'd pull it, kind of forcibly bring all the people and put them in a room, and then they would ask anyone that did have papers that was legal, you know, would be treated just like people that were undocumented. Mm-hmm. They would all be assumed to be guilty until they could prove they were innocent. And then people who did have valid green cards would be allowed to leave. And all the rest of the people would be taken up to Bellingham. And they would be photographed and fingerprinted and then shipped down in one of the buses for detainees and down to Seattle and put in detention there. And within about 48 hours, they'd all be flown down to either Ciudad Juarez or Tijuana. Deported.
And then they're just, you go to the Tijuana airport and...
Yeah, they just let them out.
And
you know, the people...
Well, aren't from Tijuana, so it's like, well, where do we go? And they don't have money. They weren't prepared to do this, so they're like really stuck.
We had, when we first started our ministry, the way we started really gaining the trust of the people is we were hearing all these reports, and that's how we started our newspaper, New Earth News, Tierra Nueva. We started documenting all the abuses. We were hearing all these stories of women being fondled by INS enforcement agents and men being beaten on and all kinds of horrible things, people's pistols being drawn on people that were trying to get away. And so we started to help the people, teach the people how to write denunciations of the abuse, and then people were really afraid to do that. But we sent many, many reports to Washington D.C., the Department of Justice, you know, complaints, official complaints, and then we started an INS watch group where we trained a number of people in how to use a video camera and what their own rights were And we started a network where people, if there was a raid happening, they could call us, and we would send two or three people with video cameras and these shirts that said INS Watch Group. And we'd say, excuse me, we're not in your way. We don't want to get in your way. We just want to make sure there's no problems here, and we're going to be filming this. And we would, then we called the INS, and we invited them to come to a public meeting, and we told them that this is what we were going to do, that we were all ready for them. And then when there were abuse, and when there were raids, we denounced everything, and we got press releases together, just had this whole network. We had pastors that would put on their collars and go to the detention center right when the people were arriving and kind of comfort the people and show the INS that we were like watching very closely. And eventually they ended up backing off and stopped their raids. The head of the INS, he's in the office one day, said, "Don't tell anyone that I said this, but we've decided to cooperate with you, and there will be no more raids." So that was pretty neat.
Well, folks do still get sent back.
Yeah.
One of the things I should say is that, because this doesn't get talked about a whole lot, but it's a major issue, and that is that a lot of times a father will be sent back, and his wife and the kids, sometimes who are American citizens, born here in the country, are still here. And I mean, there have been cases where someone has been picked up and they had like the car keys and the house keys on them. Mm-hmm. So I mean, both folks are coming up saying, well, he didn't come home for dinner tonight. And then we realize that he's been picked up and he has the house keys.
Or kids would be left alone coming home from school and like their parents didn't show up.
Right. They were working together.
Like off.
And then, say the woman was at home taking care of the kids, they now have no source of income. They have an apartment to pay, and, the kids have to go to school and food on the table. And the father's being shipped back to Mexico. So that end is, you rarely hear about it, but that's perhaps the most tragic part of this whole thing.
We had a case that I asked for prayer here at Holden a couple weeks ago, where this one weekend, like four people were in INS detention, and one of the guys had been in my jail Bible study, and I'd accompanied him until he went to prison. He only went to prison for a month and then was deported. But his daughter, his wife and daughter, two daughters are in the United States, and his one daughter has severe kidney problems and needs to go every, like twice a month to Children's Orthopedic Hospital. And so the wife thought, called me and said, well, should I wire him money to have him come back? Because, we really want our daughter to be able to have this treatment. What kind of risk is there? And I said, well, there's risk that they could prosecute him federally for illegal reentry after a felony. But, I haven't seen that happen after only one deportation. Well, the guy came back and he was caught down in San Diego. And his name's Jose Luis. And they've had him in the jail there, and they put him through the process and said they were going to give him 5 years for illegal reentry. So one of the things that we do in our advocacy, too, is we pray for people in our group. We have a gathering every Sunday night, and we pray. We gather in a big circle and hold hands, and we just pray for every one of these cases. And then we ask Holden to pray. And we had a really amazing thing. The next day after I asked for prayer here for three different individuals who were all in INS detention, they were all released the next day. And we see that often, where God seems to act. And it's just unexplainable that this guy who was looking at 5 years for federal time for illegal reentry was released the next day. It just doesn't happen. You don't see it happen. And then these other two people, too, were out. So we take our advocacy before this. The parakaleo, the one who calls out from beside, is one who calls out from beside to the judge or to any accuser, but also to God, right?
I was just wondering, if a family comes and is doing seasonal work and they're not deported, and since they're not residents of the United States, well, not legal residents, what happens during the winter? How can they survive? Or is it just support systems pull together, or they find other?
¿Qué hace la gente durante el invierno cuando no hay trabajo y cuando no hay cosecha para sobrevivir?
These guys are an example.
We work in the beet harvest when we're able.
Which goes on quite late.
Oh, okay.
A very little.
So there's.
¿Y qué otras cosas hace? ¿Qué hace la los demás gentes?
Pescadería.
People working fish processing.
Yeah, I guess in some place like Washington, kind of there's, it's not just frozen over and you can rent
it. Yeah. Although they are, they're definitely the tight times. I mean, they definitely don't have the income that they have during the summer months, during the winter months.
We have periods in December and January. It's the hardest time. And there's very little work. We have a lot of people just desperate during those times. And some of the people will, three or four families will move into an apartment together. And there'll be, I've seen people, as many as 25 people in a two-bedroom apartment. You know, and that's not because of the culture, you know, and that they like to be all, you know, together. It's mostly because there's no work, and it's just a way for them to squeak by when there's no work. Estoy diciendo que mucha gente vive amontonado, 25 personas en dos apartamentos,
sí.
Pero y no es porque los latinos así son, les gusta vivir amontonado, es más porque no hay manera, ¿verdad?, de sobrevivir sin hacer esto.
Sí, pero ya ahorita ahí en los apartamentos donde vivimos nosotros, ya nomás quieren, como yo,
una pareja
y sus dos niños, no más gente.
Now in our apartments where we live, they only allow for one couple and a couple of children.
Pero en veces sí,
and they check.
En veces se ve uno obligado, pues alguien, un amigo familiar de confianza que vive uno con uno porque
so
para pagar la renta.
To bring in someone like a family member or a friend to help to live with us to help pay the rent.
Pero siempre lo hace uno igual de la misma manera de contrabando ilegalmente.
But we do it in the same illegal way against the rules.
Y tenemos que trabajar. Sí. Forzosamente de una u otra manera tenemos que trabajar. No, aunque exista el welfare para nosotros.
Even though welfare exists, but welfare just we don't qualify for it.
Porque somos ilegales.
Because we're illegal.
Nosotros no tenemos derecho absolutamente a nada de eso.
So we have absolutely no rights for welfare.
There's this myth that that a lot of these migrant folks are coming and taking away benefits, you know, that would normally go to the American folks that really need welfare, but like I said, it's just a myth.
Como esas canarias que hay ahorita, como la trap en baile, las pescaderías, como cuando la nieve.
Some of the canneries in like places like fish processing and chicken processing plants.
Que hay gente que tiene sus papeles buenos, se va de vacaciones.
There are people that go on vacation during who have good papers.
Y nos quedamos los que no tenemos papeles.
And so we who don't have papers, we
queremos ingresar a ese trabajo.
We want to get those jobs when they're gone.
Realmente están las puertas cerradas o laqueadas, como dicen.
But the doors are all closed to us because that's in part because the INS has cracked down on all these canneries. Which makes it really hard for them to hire
pero
a doctor.
¿Sabe que hace poco pasó algo chistoso?
But something funny happened recently.
Un hombre que es ciudadano mexicano, pero es nacido en Guatemala.
A man who's a Mexican citizen, but who was born in Guatemala.
Fueron a pedir trabajo a la Draper Valley.
He went to ask for work in Draper Valley.
Y fueron honrados, dijeron que no tenían papeles.
And he said he was honest and said he didn't have papers.
Y les dieron, como no tenían gente, les dieron la oportunidad.
And because they didn't have enough people, they gave
them
jobs.
3 meses.
For 3 months.
O sea, ya después de 3 meses por ley les tocan prestaciones.
And then after 3 months they have to give people, legally they're required to give them benefits. And so they fired him at the end of 3 months to not pay benefits.
You know, one of the things that happened after the last amnesty in 1986, I don't remember hearing about that, where they gave a blanket amnesty to 3 million. Undocumented workers. As part of that package, they had what they called employer sanctions. That if you're an employer, you hire illegals, you get fined. What it turns out is that they're not really employer sanctions so much as they are employee sanctions. Because what it meant was that anyone who was in those jobs illegally can't move now because now they really do check your papers. And the folks who have illegal workers know that the door is closed pretty much anywhere else. So they can basically use and abuse their workers, knowing they've got really limited options now as to where they can go. Whereas before, there's probably more possibility of a an illegal worker being hired in a number of different places, that's not the case. So those that do take them in have this amazing control over them now. And it's so, again, kind of backfired. So it's the employees who really get hit.
One of the things that people can do that we're really encouraging is to pressure Congress and senators to, you know, write letters to encourage them to put to go for an amnesty for undocumented people, you know, which Bush was talking about, but now he's kind of backed off because of political pressure. But an amnesty would just make life so much better for so many people that we serve.
And besides, people just come back again and it wastes so much of our money. You know, the taxpayers' money to send them back, and then they come back in, and they go back, and, you know, it's just ridiculous.
Almost everyone that we see deported is back within a couple of weeks. But
having to pay at a great financial cost.
Exactly. To cross over.
At a great financial cost to the U.S. government and also to the to the people. They pay $1,500 per person just to get across the border.
Pues como yo hay que yo le he dicho a mis amigos, o sea, vale más adaptarnos al trabajo del fin, que es raro que el patrón te pide el seguro bueno, ¿eh? Como yo en mi caso.
It's better for me, I say to my friends, it's better to adapt ourselves to field work rather than having to deal with having people request good papers from us, you know, green cards.
Because as a farmer, it's rare that they would ask.
Yeah.
Yo he trabajado como en construcciones, he trabajado en cemento.
I worked doing cement work.
Para un poco de profesión de cemento, como hacer como jardines japoneses.
And I know how to do Japanese.
Puentes artificiales.
And artificial like fountains.
Y por lo mismo que no tengo permiso, no puedo adaptar a un trabajo como profesionista.
¿Cómo?
Como puedo yo hacer cosas desde concreto y cosas.
Yeah, and I can do this since I can do those kind of jobs.
De piedras así va a hacer todo trabajo.
Making like rockery stuff like that.
No me animo a buscar trabajo como profesionista.
I don't feel like I have to get a job like a professional person, where I have to have papers.
He tenido patrones de construcciones que me han dicho si tú te pones a que sea a hablar inglés y alguien que te ayude a sacar un papel puedes tener trabajo conmigo hasta 20 dólares a la hora.
Construction companies tell me that if I could learn English and if I could help, you know, they give me a job, and especially if I could get bad papers.
Hace dos meses hice un trabajo para Bitcoin de Anacuera. Hice un trabajo de cantera. Cuando terminé el trabajo, le salió el trabajo $300. En una casa bonita que tiene para la playa. Y me dijo el hombre, hablaba español, dice, ¿cuánto crees que me haya costado este trabajo con un contratista? Le dije, yo entiendo lo que te ha costado, yo sé lo que más o menos te ha salido, pero... Pero mientras sigues haciendo trabajo a mí, las cosas te van a salir más baratas conmigo.
But if you let me do the work,
le gustó mi trabajo.
It'll be less expensive, and that's a good deal for you.
Y en un día y medio lo hice un
de
así de porque aquí cuenta por pieza, ¿verdad? Le gustaron grande, pura y con pura arena, no con puro piedra bonita.
Beautiful wall.
Sí.
No, it looks like we're out of time here. Yes.
Again, if you haven't asked, please sign up for an occasional email from us. If you want to hear from us ever again, your email or your address. And then there's also some brochures and flyers and stuff like that that's free of charge.
And please do feel free to seek us out if you'd like to have a conversation in the form of us or Lucas. We'd be happy to transmit that.
I think tomorrow night here, is there going to be
a forum?
Yeah, a forum about more detail about the other wave and the people's seminary, what exactly you do, how you do it, why you do it, what against the rest of you doing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Gracias.